The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. It is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, awarded Best Bank for Financing in Africa at the Euro Money Awards for Excellence. Welcome to The Money Show on this Thursday evening. It's teeing up to be an eventful Friday, I suspect. It would seem that the ANC earlier today was playing down the idea of a big cabinet reshuffle. And now Eyewitness News tells us, and I am sure that they're accurate, that various people are being summoned to the meetings with the president this evening to discuss changes to cabinet. Long overdue changes to cabinet. Looking forward to a discussion in a moment with Lumkile Mondi from the School of Economics and Business Science at WITS. I'm looking forward to catch up with him as the ANC finds itself in the midst of a long overdue shuffle at the head of government. And you might have heard Stephen Friedman on the radio earlier today saying it doesn't really make a difference who the political head of the ministry is until you get some significant change in ethos and policy from the very, very top of the ANC. Doesn't really matter who is running things. In a couple of minutes' time, Dr. Leila Fourie, Chief Executive of JC Limited. We've got Pavlo, we've got Warren Ingram, and of course, Nick Haralambos talking side hustles in a tough economy. That is all coming up this evening on The Money Show.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, are we seeing positive signs for the first time for a long time out of Cyril Ramaphosa's presidency in terms of who might be running government departments? Lumkile Mondi watches this stuff very closely. He's a senior lecturer at the School of Economics and Business Science at WITS University, and he's on the line to us this evening. Lumkile, give me your perspective on this evening. After earlier playing down reports of an imminent cabinet reshuffle, Jesse Duarte, now it looks like the top six will be meeting this evening, the ANC and other alliance members, to get a briefing from the president on what his thinking is.
Good evening, Bruce and your listeners. Yes, it's happening at last. It is happening at the back of a huge embarrassment, particularly for the president, who has played a long game. Remember, Bruce, many of us expected him, after he had been chosen by South Africans in 2018 to really introduce untainted and grow South Africa individuals competent to try and rebuild the state which had been destroyed by former President Jacob Zuma. So this change here has really been catalyzed by the recent events in KwaZulu-Natal and parts of Gauteng. And we expect him really to take a much bolder action than what expected, given that he has overwhelming support from many South Africans who want to support him, who are volunteering to serve, given the fact that if we don't take decisive action, we may as well fail to address the problem of state building, and more importantly, of a growing economy that can enable us to deal with the challenges of the day.
It's so interesting how the desires, the needs, the wishes of the great South African public are not necessarily reflected in the political sphere. I mean, the president has been pushing a big stone uphill in his various efforts to try to, you know, drive reform within the ANC, only to have constant pushback within the top six of the ANC. And that has been, I think, a very, very difficult set of hurdles for him to mount.
Absolutely. I think there's been a great confusion among many in the ANC, maybe given because of the institutional outlook of the ANC itself, where the ANC at times is seen to be itself a constitutional state. By that, I mean undermining and being above the constitutional state as the so-called leader of society, and therefore believing that when politicians in the cabinet of an ANC government are caught as we've seen with Dr. Mkhize recently, who allegedly has submitted a letter of resignation because he's scared of being fired, rather walk the plank, as people are saying in the social media at the moment. Therefore, the fact that they've seen themselves above the constitution, and even the consultation that is taking place at the moment, is going to be a compromise, because really, if South Africa is going to rebuild state capacity, is going to be able to effectively deal with the challenges that we're facing of declining investor confidence, of destroyed infrastructure, both rail, electricity, road, it needs capability, and that capability will then lead to confidence and therefore investment. So we see this as an opportunity for him to put that across to his colleagues. But at the same time, I think there'll be a lot of dealing and of dealing among them, because they are more interested in making sure that the party can unite behind him in the face of the elections that are coming locally and in the next 2 years at national level.
Does anything change? I mean, so yes, you get a couple of we do get a couple of names changing at the top of the lists, and that's all well and good. But fundamentally, does anything change? Many commentators are suggesting nothing actually does change. Until the ANC changes, the rest of us simply are victims of an inept running of the state.
Bruce, the good lessons that to learn from is just in front of us. The so-called Arab Spring, if you remember, was hailed as an inflection point, particularly in the North East Africa, in Egypt, in Tunisia, and other countries. And we all know now what's happened there. That basically the euphoria, same as the Ramaphosa that you experienced, led to naught. So basically, there's a noise, there's a shuffling, there's a regime change, but actually the same elite that still believes. So what you're going to see is going to be basically the same ANC people who are going to come in, whose main interest is going to be ANC. So really, nothing much changes until our president, or things much broader outside the party, about some form of government of national unity, and then therefore bring in capability within the state. I think that positive sign will go a long way for us to have a much more different outcome than the Arab state that experienced the Arab Spring some years ago.
Lumkile Mondi, thank you. Senior lecturer at Wits University, the School of Economics and Business Science. Certainly the Mail and Guardian this evening is reporting that the president has called a meeting with top officials. Insiders say it's likely to focus on a cabinet reshuffle. Sources close to suspended health ministers William Kesey also told the Mail and Guardian that he had tendered his resignation on Thursday afternoon. Nobody rushes with resignations. Nobody is that quick to chuck in the towel, because the huge amounts of vested interest are there. You hold on to the very last minute, perhaps until all hope is lost that you are going to either be able to hold on to your job or be shuffled elsewhere. Well, big debates also globally on how to deal with going back to work with people who won't get vaccinated against COVID-19. Some companies are thinking about exclusion altogether, saying, well, then don't come back to the office at all. In fact, you may have to tender your resignation. Others are looking at incentives, and that includes Vanguard, which is one of the world's biggest investment firms, and it's going to pay its American workers $1,000 each if they get vaccinated. Staff have got to prove that they had the vaccination by October, and they'll still qualify, though, if they were inoculated before this offer. Some companies, Microsoft and Google amongst them, are saying that all staff must get vaccines before coming back. Others, Walmart and Uber, saying that their management teams are getting vaccines, but frontline staff, not so sure. And also Amazon and Apple don't have a policy in place either. And we are seeing this huge surge in new COVID infections across the United States. We're seeing it happening across Europe. And of course, we've gone through a dreadful third wave in South Africa too. Should we be obliging people or maybe incentivizing people to have their vaccines, pay them to do so and exclude them for not doing so? Dr. Lela Fareed, Chief Executive at JSE Limited, the company that runs the stock market. Half year results from JSE Limited today showing the business of the exchange coming under pressure compared to the massively volatile first half of last year, of course. Lela, before we talk about results, might you consider an incentive to get your staff back to work, vaccinated or not?
Well, certainly, Bruce, we are encouraging people to get vaccinated, but I'm a strong libertarian, and so free market forces need to prevail, and people need to make their own choices. Of course, we do encourage it.
People make their own choices, but if I know that Johnny and Freddie either side of me in the cubicles are not vaccinated, and I am, and I'm still vulnerable and may take the virus home to an elderly parent, then is it my right to not come back to work because no one's insisting on my neighbours on being vaccinated? I think you know, we all face this particular problem right now. You're not going to enforce anything, though.
No, we don't have any plans at this stage to enforce anything. But as I said, we certainly are encouraging people, and we'll see how that unfolds. I suspect that travel incentives will be a much more powerful incentive than we would be encouraging people to come back to work.
Exactly, I think so. Get out of the house and maybe go on a holiday again one day. Look, you had a much tougher first half this year than last year, which is ironic considering just how much better stock markets did in the first half of this year compared to the first half of last year. But when it comes to running the stock market, you don't care whether the level's at, you know, 1,000 or 60,000, unless people, you know, as long as people are trading and trading a lot and often.
Well, Bruce, we faced a confluence of three events, effectively, and notwithstanding the fact that the exchange all-share index is up 15%, that growth in the market is achieved through much lower relative volumes and values. And so the first big factor that affected our position was the high base effect, and that was caused by enormous hyper-volatility last year. We are so tightly correlated to market value that it does tend to distort our performance. And although we were down this year by 8% in the equity market revenue, when we compare ourselves to the base of 2019, which is a much more reasonable and normalized base, we're up 15% on both volume and value, and we would be up 16% in revenue. So the market is growing, and it's growing well, and it would be naive for us not to have expected this drop. The results are very much in line with our budgets. They were expected, and they are typical following a market moving event.
It certainly is. I mean, volatility is wild and unsettling to most of us, but that frenzied buying and selling activity, of course, is great for business volumes. It really is. When it comes to, and we often talk about this, I mean, the number of delistings that we're seeing on our stock market, I think Imperial Logistics is one of the most recent, and I chatted to the chief executive the other day saying not even the riots are in around Durban and KZN and the riots around Joburg were enough to put his Dubai-based investors off. They're looking long term. We're just seeing so many really good South African companies being taken out at some fairly significant premiums.
Certainly, and I ultimately, one could argue, Bruce, that when companies, when they are corporate action, it unlocks shareholder value. And the purpose of the exchange is to enable capital formation and to create value. And so we've seen many companies coming in, growing tremendously, and then being taken out through a corporate action. And the shareholders have walked away with a smile on their faces. And so it's our job, really, really to enable that free capital formation. So in many ways, that those sorts of transactions are value creating. The number of delistings are also largely either scheme arrangements or particularly in the small and mid-cap market, which was really hard hit during the downturn. But we are really pleased with the performance of the small cap market. Small cap market is up 28%, and our Alt-X is up nearly 26% year to date. So these markets do tend to bounce back much quicker than one would expect, and they are showing promising growth.
Do you not worry that we get to a point, though, where the JSE, which has got fewer and fewer and fewer investable companies on it from an asset management perspective, simply becomes irrelevant to the vast majority of investors, most of whom who can take their money and put it anywhere in the world?
Bruce, if you have a look at the market cap of the JSE, we have grown tremendously. In fact, we've grown by 5% year to date and 11% year on year if we compare ourselves to last year this time. So while the nominal number of listings has declined, we still have an incredibly deep franchise of very good quality listed companies, and many of them are dual listed, so top rated at a global level. So we are resilient, and this trend that we're seeing is not unique to South Africa. If you look at the World Federation stats, World Federation of Exchanges, we are better performing than the London Stock Exchange. Over the last 10 years, the London Stock Exchange has contracted by 21%. The JSE has contracted by 15%, and the New York Stock Exchange by the JSE contracted by 17%, and the New York Stock Exchange by 15%. So, yes, we are contracting globally, but I wouldn't be as extreme to say that we'll become irrelevant. We are also future-proofing ourselves by investing in a private market capital formation space where investors will be able to invest, and issuers can raise capital in the SME market and also in the infrastructure market. And that'll be a sort of no-frills, less onerous regulatory oversight type environment.
Dr. Leila Fareed, thank you, Leila. She is Chief Executive of JSE Limited.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Rudy Funimadva is our market commentator this evening. And Rudy, I mean, just looking at today's activity on the JSE, the resources sector, which has been the stalwart of the JSE for so long, finally taking a breather. And when it does, oh my goodness me, it looks a bit ugly, doesn't it?
It does, Bruce. Yeah, it's a bit of a two-speed market today. The resources weren't good. They had a tough time of it today. And we also had Naspers and Prosus also making negative returns on the day. So you know, that's a massive weighting on the overall indices. So that didn't look very pretty. But nonetheless, there are segments of the market that actually did very well. You know, the banking sector had a blistering day, and so did the domestic retailers. Very, very attractive returns in those spaces. The more South African focused companies actually had a very good day.
Well, it all came. I mean, the Nedbank trading update came out this time yesterday after the market had closed. And by when we opened this morning, you couldn't buy a bank share anywhere. It was like panic buying almost as investors piled into bank shares, because that Nedbank trading update suggested that certainly for the banks, the environment has been a little less awful than had been anticipated.
Yeah, I think it has taken the market by surprise. Certainly, I've been pleasantly surprised by that. You know, there's been some anticipation of the rollback of all the provisions that the banks have put in place over the last while. But certainly, Nedbank's trading update set the market alight, as you said. You know, I think Nedbank was up over 9% today. Absa was up over 8% today. The sector really came to life, and prospects are looking good there.
Yeah, I mean, the banking shares did well today. The insurance companies did exceptionally well today as well. It was just the resources and, of course, Naspers and Prosus, which we've spoken about extensively in recent weeks, which are feeling the pain of Chinese regulation and authorities in that part of the world, making life very difficult for domestic companies. What about the performance of JSE Limited, the company that runs the market, that whose chief executive we just spoke to?
Yeah, the stock price was, I think, up about 25%, Bruce. You know, the results, I think, coming off a high base last year, possibly look worse than they are, but there was a high base impact. Trading value of transactions dropped by about 8% and the actual volume of transactions by about 19%. So that has a significant impact, and their earnings were down resultantly 26% on the previous year, which isn't particularly pretty. You know, it is and at the same time we had a cost escalations of in the region of sort of 6%. It's a difficult space. You know, it's an interesting company from a dividend yield perspective, but I think growth is likely to be constrained going forward, and we're going to find alternative exchanges, you know, increasingly becoming more important as they offer cheaper trading facilities and cheaper listing. So I think it's going to be, they can find it difficult to get any real growth going forward.
Yeah, it is a very, very tough environment, of course, and Leila Fourie putting a brave face, of course, on the huge delistings boom that we're seeing and the fact that the JSE is 15% smaller than it was a couple of years ago. It's hard to compare us, though, on the JSE versus the New York Stock Exchange and the London Stock Exchange, simply because our stock exchange is so much smaller. A 15% decline in listings on the JSE proportionately seems a lot more serious than a 21% decline for the London Stock Exchange, which has got thousands.
Yeah, Bruce, I was speaking about this with somebody recently, and our market, the investable universe, just seems to perpetually shrink. A lot of companies that have the ability to do so have been effectively migrating a big chunk of their capital offshore over time. And what then ends up happening is, you know, they split off those businesses and the domestic portion just perpetually seems to shrink. A lot of the attractive companies are taken private and delist, as you mentioned. So you know, we need that universe to grow, and the way to do that is to make this an attractive destination for capital, for raising capital and for investing capital. Certainty about regulation and prospects would help, be very helpful.
Well, there's a huge amount of breaking news happening this evening. We're going to go to Eyewitness News with that. And yes, the president coming out of the presidency this evening, we are expecting an announcement on something, changes to the national executive at 8:30 this evening. We hold thumbs, Rudy, that this is perhaps the sign of things to come.
Yeah, absolutely, Bruce, from your lips to God's ears.
Well, just the union buildings is fine. We'll go that far. At least we know we can have some impact there. Rudy Fadabadva, thank you very much. Rudy is our market commentator this evening, and Rudy is a portfolio manager at AdviceWorks. The nation holds its breath to see what changes, if anything significant occurs. Let's have the latest Eyewitness News.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, collaborating with our clients in the pursuit of excellence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show, brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, awarded Best Bank for Financing in Africa at the Euro Money Awards for Excellence. This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. I'm curious as to how markets are going to respond to the president's announcement tomorrow morning. We'll know at 8:30 this evening, or 9:00, or 9:30. Well, we'll know, hopefully this evening, what the president's intentions are. It's been a bit of a weird week. I mean, we've had really high-placed sources within the ANC telling highly respected journalists who trust their sources of imminent change and a determination to change. The president himself has hinted at it. And then Jesse Duarte, the acting secretary general of the ANC, seemed to suggest that it was all a bunch of rubbish. she seemed to play down the speculation. And then Eyewitness News learned that the president had summoned various alliance members and some senior members of the top six of the ANC to talk to them about this issue. And there no doubt will be lots of last-minute horse trading amongst people who will be seeking to further their own agendas, looking to extend their own careers. But the reports this evening suggesting that Zweli Mkhize has stepped aside, and that provides an opportunity for a change at the top, long overdue change at the top, as we now know needs to happen within the Department of Health. How to destroy a legacy in with making some extremely poor decisions. And then within the security cluster and many other parts of government, frankly, as well, the opportunity to sweep clean. But when you sweep clean, what do you replace? With whom do you replace leaders who have failed, leaders who have not grasped the nettle, have not grasped the opportunity? That is the big question, I suppose, with which the president has been wrestling for so long. I mean, Tito Mboweni was brought back into the fold of the ANC from outside of formal politics, once, you know, to take over, when Cyril Ramaphosa must have looked around at his cabinet table and said, OK, anybody who did not go to the Sachsenwald Tribune, please put up your hands, because he was embarrassed by the fact that he had to ask Nhlanhla Nene to step aside after he told Porky Pies about going ill-advised, ill-judged lies about not going to the Gupta residence. And so, you know, so many people compromised at the upper echelons of South African society and politics. So many people. So, yes, looking forward to seeing what he has to say. Does it make the slightest bit of difference? Markets don't think so this evening. It's looking at the currency market unmoved. Unmoved. We'll watch this space very closely from 8:30 this evening.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, we've been talking about technology companies and lots of people in financial technology businesses who've been raising money recently to have a huge impact on South African society. Yesterday, we spoke about Naked Insurance that raised 120 million rand. Last week, it was, of course, Katlego Mapai and Yoko, which had raised 1.2 billion rand. Well, a UK business called CUDA Technologies has just raised $55 million, which is over a billion rand, and it's got a fund which in March 2021 also raised another $25 million, and it wants to drive an expansion into selected African countries. And CUDA Technologies, it's a what they call themselves a challenger bank for Africa, looking to expand that challenger bank in an environment which is becoming increasingly contested. Let's join this evening Ryan Lopesher, who's Chief Operating Officer at CUDA Bank. Tell us this evening, if you would, Ryan, all about CUDA and what your plans are.
Good evening, Bruce. Great to be here, and thanks for having me on the show. You know, it's exciting times for CUDA. It's you know, we launched the business in October 2019, and it was you know, it was two founders who had an idea, very much you know married to what's been happening amongst the neobanking space in Europe with Revolut, Monzo, Starling. And their thinking was, you know, if it can work really well, providing really affordable access to banking and financial services in Europe, why not for Africa? So they came out with that dream, and they actually did the pitch here in South Africa through SA Bootcamp. And I think won that particular competition, and basically launched the business in Nigeria. The two of them are, the two founders are from Nigeria. They are British educated, and I think saw what was happening in the United Kingdom and decided that it was ripe for the picking to take this type of concept back to Nigeria and bring affordable, better banking to people in Nigeria. So that was back in October 2019. If you fast forward to present day, we now have around just under 1.5 million customers in Nigeria alone. And this current funding raise that you just mentioned is largely going to be spent on the expansion outside of Nigeria as we start to look at other interesting geographics throughout Africa, including the United Kingdom, where there's a large diaspora of Africans, and then probably slightly later into other European countries where we all look to connect the pipes and connect people with their money and their loved ones, and offer them a much more affordable way to send and receive money, you know, backwards and forwards from Europe and from the UK and Africa. And also just a bank, access to credit, access to products that shouldn't have a fee attached to them, but in so many African markets have a pretty large fee attached to almost anything. Mm. So we've decided that that's the type of service that we want to bring to Africa, and the hard work, I think, lies ahead of us now.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the easy stuff is the tech. Lagos, London, and Cape Town, you've got offices in all of those jurisdictions. Do you look to bring CUDA as a banking offering to South Africa? And if so, how far through the very, very tough regulatory rigmarole are you here?
Yeah, it's definitely not, I was going to say not very high on the list. It's actually not on the list. You know, South Africa's got pretty good banking. I think it's got pretty good banking by international standards, not just by African standards.
Yeah.
It's fiercely competitive. The regulatory environment is and rightly so, is very stringent. And quite frankly, when we look at the type of banking that people have to deal with in countries like Uganda, Ghana, Tanzania, DRC, we feel that people in those countries deserve a far better service for them to actually manage their financial well-being. And so those are going to be the countries that are on the priority list. You know, maybe at a later stage, we'll take a look at South Africa. But when you look at, you know, the very good banking that already exists, it just makes it not as good a use of capital, time, or people, or resource, quite frankly.
My thanks to Ryan Lopeshire this evening, Chief Operating Officer at CUDA. It's an opportunity. It's an African opportunity. And it's interesting that they are avoiding South Africa as a market right now. And that's hardly surprising, considering this huge growth that we've seen in the challenger banks, if you like. Capitec was the first of those successful challenger banks, today with 15 million customers. More recently, we've seen Discovery Bank, and it's been signing up lots of customers, as has Time Bank. And hopefully soon, Bank Zero will find its way to the market as well. I've got a feeling it's got to be announced fairly soon. There would be a very, very tough environment for CUDA to compete in. But yeah, interesting. 1.5 million customers in Nigeria and looking to connect the African diaspora in different parts of the world. It's an interesting idea.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Neko Lambos is a hustler, and he talks side hustles. He has written books on how to create your side hustle. He runs the slowhustle.org venture. Be giving away R1,000 a day for weeks and weeks and weeks to worthy contenders, some of the 14, 15,000 people who've applied for the R1,000, and some tutoring by Nick himself in order to set up their micro enterprises. And we're starting to see some really nice traction come through there. Neko Lambos, a couple of side hustles before we go into some lessons, if we don't mind. This is a classic, I suppose, global side hustle. If you go to many poorer parts of the world, trading food is an absolute core starter point for so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is nothing wrong with simple and effective and tried and tested and true. And that's exactly what Leseko is doing in Springs. She goes out and finds fresh produce from wherever she can, farms, neighbors, whoever's around, and then adds a markup and sells them on. And it is just so simple and elegant, and it is what it is. And it's what I keep telling people is your side hustle needs to cater for your needs. And if your needs are an extra R500 a week, then great. This side hustle would do that.
I just read the wonderful story of Frank Magwegwe, who became an executive in insurance. And I mean, he spent many, many months, I think 10 or 11 months, 93, 94, living rough on the streets. And he survived by working on somebody's vegetable stall and surviving off the scraps at the end of the day, and finally getting a few bucks and starting his own stalls, and then hiring people to run stalls, and having time then to go to the library, meeting the librarian and learning about actuarial science and setting himself up for a great life. I mean, great things can come from seemingly very, very simple idea. Another great idea is this idea that you can have access to the internet. Your friends and colleagues might not have access to the internet, so you might be able to turn that into a business.
Yeah, that's exactly what Tumo pitched me. And I got to say, I've watched lots of ISPs launch. The RSA Web guys are friends and they've done amazing things. And I was skeptical about this one. But Tumo has a captive audience, which I think is the key here. So Tumo used a 1,000 rand fee that we gave him to sign up to a business partner program for an ISP. And his captive audience is students who are leaving varsity and want to get internet installed in their homes or in their rent share or whatever. So in spite of this being a relatively cluttered market, the thing that enticed me about it is having a specific audience and a specific goal of how many people he wants to sell to every month. And that was an easy game.
And yeah, so good for Tumo and good for Lesejo for grabbing the opportunity that is being presented by Nick Haralambos. Talk to me about leading versus lagging indicators when it comes to micro enterprises and how we tell the difference and how we use them differently.
Yeah, often, I mean, even on bigger businesses, we get these indicators confused. If you're listening, you've heard of KPIs, key performance indicators, but some of those indicators lead and some of them lag. And an example here to make this clearer is a leading indicator would be, for example, how many sales calls you make every day. That predicts the future success or failure of your business, while a lagging indicator is the income produced from sales, your revenue. And so often what will happen is a small business owner will look at their revenue and go, oh, things are amazing, but they haven't made any sales calls. So the leading indicators are letting them down because they're not looking at sales calls, they're looking at revenue. So it's just important to understand that there is a difference. You should go and research the difference and you should track relevant indicators for your small business.
And those indicators, I mean, it is about having, you know, what is the line? You can't fix what you can't measure. You can't measure what you can't see. What are the lines? There's something along those lines.
Something to that effect. I'm with you. I know what line you're talking about, but that's exactly right. Or you can't predict what you can't measure. Something to that line.
Yeah, but that's the point. I mean, we think that data and we think that information is the preserve of large businesses, but each and every sale is a potential next sale. Every single lead is access to potentially a new customer. And you've really got to keep track of this stuff as a startup.
Yeah, and I think one of the issues is if you aren't keeping track of these things, what you're doing is not paying attention to your business. And it's such something that so many small business owners get wrong is they think that because they're generating income, their business is on track. But there are lots of indicators that you should be looking at that just keep your eye on the ball and keep your finger on the pulse. And if you're not looking at them at all, when are you going to know that things are going down?
And how is the cash gathering for the side hustles going, Nick? Are you finding the support that you need to keep going?
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm still bound to not talk, but in the next week or two, I will have some really big announcements to make. We are making immense progress and the fund is growing and we are doing lots more than just giving away 1,000 rand and 30 minutes of my time. We're going to be educating people through online programs and a whole bunch of things that we will announce very, very soon.
I cannot wait. Nick Haralambos, thank you very much indeed. Nick Haralambos is he's a small businessman, but that would be unkind. He is the startup king of many small enterprises. He's written books on the subject, and of course he is slowhustle.org if you're looking for support.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield, and it's good to be in your company this evening here on The Money Show. Pavlo Fotidis from Auric Business Accelerator joins us in a bit. We are also going to be talking to Warren Ingram tonight. But first, a discussion on the restaurant industry. It's an industry that has taken so much strain in the last while. We'll pick up on that story in just a bit. The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, awarded Best Bank for Financing in Africa at the Euro Money Awards for excellence. Welcome to tonight's show. The cabinet reshuffle is so interesting already. Speculation is wild. Not expecting this to happen, not expecting that to happen. Frankly, it doesn't matter what we expect. The facts will be spelled out at 8:30 this evening. And I suppose there's a bit of an ego battle between the forecasters, people who want to say, you see, we told you. So we watch this space. I'm interested to see what comes out of a media briefing, which is happening tomorrow at 10 a.m. And it's the founder and chairman of African Rainbow Energy and Power, Dr. Patrice Motsepe, the chief executive of African Rainbow Energy and Power. That's Brian Damas, former CEO of Eskom, of course. And they've got a media conference happening at 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. I wonder what that could be about. We've not heard very much at all in the 55 days since the president announced that there would be changes in the way that electricity would be generated into the future, and that the government would be allowing companies to generate 100 megawatts of their own electricity. We've not heard anything since then. I'm wondering whether Patrice and Brian will be announcing something significant in that particular environment tomorrow. It makes sense. It really does make sense that Patrice would be an early mover. He is well-connected. He has lots of capital. He has for a long time. Brian Damas has been employed in this business for an awfully long time. My guess is they've been planning to capitalize on the electricity crunch that the country faces. We'll watch that space very closely. I've asked my producers to put in a pitch about this particular story already today. We see today that Niederberg says it is offering a helping hand to restaurants and staff. And that's really nice to see as well. It's going to spend nearly R1 million to encourage diners to return to their favorite licensed restaurants, their licensed eateries. It's a campaign designed to boost the beleaguered restaurant sector. That's nice to see. They're going to work with about 150 restaurants across the country, and they're going to give away 600,000 rand in vouchers via selected retailers that can be redeemed during August and September, which is nice to see as well. Of course, the South African wine industry has been battered and bruised, and no doubt there have been many, many closures of estates that simply can't cope with the fact that there's a lot of the time of the year that you have not been able to sell your product. But Niederberg is big. Niederberg is taking this initiative. Neil Groenewald is the managing director at Niederberg. How are you choosing these 150 restaurants to team up with, Neil?
Hi, good evening, Bruce. Well, so we basically went out and asked who was available, who wanted to participate in the initiative, and it was also selected by the outlets that actually stock our wine. So there was a combination of criteria for them to get to the final list of restaurants.
Excellent. And I mean, it's a way, I suppose, of promoting a wine in an environment where, you know, sales have been dismal. We've lost months and months of sales over the last 15 months.
That's true. And I think the restaurant industry was maybe targeted the hardest through this time. And this initiative is really to try and kickstart people going back to the restaurants. And that's what we're trying to do. And on the back of that, obviously, promote the brand Niederberg and show that we care.
There's an incentive here also for staff within the restaurants to promote your wines, and I like this because it's a smart marketing initiative. If they succeed in convincing diners to buy your wine over another wine, there's a cash incentive in there as well.
That's correct. You can lead somebody to the water, but then it's about drinking it, and that's just the final step to make sure that our efforts actually get converted into sales as well.
There was once a guy who converted water into wine. I don't know if you know that particular story. I don't know what it tasted like.
I've heard of that guy.
Exactly. Don't you wish it was that easy? How is Niederberg holding up? I mean, Niederberg is a household name. I remember growing up as a kid, there were bottles of Edelrot and Baron proudly on the table. I think there was Weisse Riesling and Stein, occasionally a late harvest. Niederberg was one of the very few wines you could get in South Africa. There's been this explosion in the wine industry over the last 30, 40 years. How are you holding up in the face of all of the real difficulties that have beset this industry over the last year and a half?
Yeah, to talk about the last year and a half, I think we need more than 5 or 10 minutes, but it's been tough. We've been resilient. We've come up with new plans on how to actually go forward, and we've actually had remarkable sales. A heritage brand like Niederberg has stood the test of time purely because it can innovate and adapt itself. We've been making wine for over 200 years, and like you said, the household name that you mentioned now, the Edelwitz and the Baronk. I mean, Baronk gets drunk every 14 seconds. The bottle gets opened somewhere in the country. So it's big brands, and people go back to big brands because of the consistency and the quality that we offer. And then also the value equation for the consumer, which I think becomes more important after a time like this, coming out of lockdown. And then also people being retrenched, job losses. So definitely people are looking for the right quality at the right price. And
is there a lot of attrition in the wine industry? Are you seeing smaller producers fold?
I've experienced a few of that. It's very sad because at the end of the day, any business is run on cash flow. So it's cash flow would be the first green principle. And if you're not very clear on how you do it, then it is possible to fold. And it's very unfortunate that this has happened. We've had a few initiatives already to help producers. And the smaller guys, because we also need them to build equity for South Africa as a category, together then with Niederberg being one of the top 50 most admired wine brands in the world. So we fight. It's about cooperation and then competition, and we're still on the cooperation side of the coin. So before no,
absolutely, you can't fight with each other if you're not going to survive. It's Neil Groenewald, thank you, managing director at Niederberg. It becomes self defeating. This industry has got to survive. It's got to thrive. It employs many hundreds of thousands of people who are dependent directly and indirectly on it in the Western Cape, particularly. But South Africa's tourism industry heavily dependent, also of course, on the wine trade and the glorious sites that perform part of the tourist routes. It's absolutely pivotal that this wine industry be allowed not only to survive, but thrive. That is absolutely pivotal. But nice to see Niederberg, which is a real old school household South African name, make contributions to the restaurant industry. And just reminds me, if you don't know about it, if you've missed out on it, a really great initiative from our colleague John Perlman, who does the afternoon drive show on 702. He announced in the last 10 days a new initiative whereby he is hoping that you will donate 300 Rand or a couple of hundred Rand, a couple of Rand, any amount of money via our Backer Buddy page on the 702.co.za website. And the purpose of this is to raise money for healthcare workers' meals. For every 300 Rand that is raised, a healthcare worker will be identified and will be given a voucher. And they'll be able to buy themselves a meal. They'll be able to order a meal for somebody at home, order a meal for a friend, or order a meal for a colleague. It doesn't really matter. The point is that to give as many healthcare workers as possible a 300 Rand Uber Eats voucher. Then Uber Eats will make sure that the food is delivered to the appropriate person at the appropriate time. Not only is it going to go a long way to helping healthcare workers, but it's got this wonderful multiplier effect in that the restaurants that are selling the food are going to be beneficiaries as well. They've been through the mill backwards. Have the restaurants. And so any initiatives like this, and well done to John Perlman for pulling this one together, and I think he's doing rather nicely. Should catch up with him in a week or two just to get a tally on how much money is being raised and just how many healthcare workers will benefit from this initiative.
The Money Show.
Small Business.
With Pavlo Fatidis.
This Small Business Focus brought to you by Productivity South Africa, providing solutions for businesses in distress. And Pavlo Fatidis, I'm sure, could help businesses in distress, but he likes hungry businesses. He likes fast-growing businesses. He likes businesses with attitude and with leaders that want to grow. Grow is what it's all about. And part of this, Pavlo, is about succession. It's about relinquishing, releasing yourself from the business and the business of you.
It is, Bruce, because if you are the business, you don't have a business, you have a job. So succession is vital. And succession isn't only about selling and handing over the business, which you find typically in the professional services industry, where, for example, in law firms or accounting practices, architectural firms really, or services really, that rely on human talent and human talent alone as a service. You also see succession, obviously, in family businesses, as the founders pass on to perhaps their kids or family members from one generation to the next. And I was reading some interesting stats the other day that in family businesses, success in succession from founder to first generation, Bruce, runs at 27% globally. It means that close to 73% of all other transfers of responsibility and the asset from the parents to the kids fail. I thought that was a terrifying statistic.
It is. I'm actually surprised that it's not higher, frankly, because you see some of the kids of rich people, and I'm surprised that the transfer is actually that successful.
Yeah. No, it look, you know, it's fraught. It's fraught with all sorts of things. We've spoken about this a little bit on and off in the Money Show, and I think it's really worth revisiting it because what I've started to notice is especially in an environment where, and not only in South Africa, I can promise you this is happening in the US and the UK as well, and Europe I'm not too sure of, but I can speak in those other jurisdictions too. I've noticed an increase, especially over this COVID period, the last 18 months, where people are saying, you know, I think we're going to build this into a family business. We're going to look at succeeding the value of our business to our kids. The job markets generally are becoming harder and harder and harder to secure. Employment levels or employment rates are uncertain. And I think that we're going to see a resurgence in family business investment. We're at the very, very early stages of it. But if you're not running a family business and you're running a normal business and you don't succeed in succession, it means you can't grow. And you can't grow because you remain the bottleneck. It means you can't hold on to good talent. Because if you've got good people in your business that have leadership aspirations, they want and need more responsibility. And it means, Bruce, that if you can't get a clean exit through a normal arm's length trade sale, you won't be able to monetize the 10, 20, 30, 40 years of investment because you won't be able to sell the team, get paid out, and through that realize the asset value of your business.
And that is, I mean, it's tragic when people work so hard in their businesses and on their businesses and have their businesses work for them. And they've got fabulous assets. They just are worth nothing, ultimately, simply because people aren't able to achieve a value for them. And, you know, you haven't handed over early enough, or, you know, by the time you are ready to hand over, your three best potential successors have given up hope. And it's absolutely critical that you don't do that.
Completely. It's, you know, this during the early part of this day, I had to speak to a group of business owners about the four definitive acts, the acts of leadership to get a business from startup all the way through to sale. And the discussion that ensued after that was universal in amongst these business owners. I think the average age of the business owner must have been about 50, 55 or so. The average age of the business must have been 20 to 25 years of age. And the discussion that ensued was around, gosh, you know, we just do what we do. We don't actually definitively think about how we should be changing our habits of how we lead and grow our businesses. We just simply do what we do. And what you said earlier, you know, after working hard, et cetera, you don't get the exit. Working hard is simply not good enough. In succession, especially, Bruce, it is something, it fails largely because it's never properly planned for. And that planning process is a six-year journey to get succession right. Mostly people consider succession the year that they want to exit the business. I'm not going to hand it over. Let's get a process going. And it often lands up as a complete disaster because of that.
So how then do you avoid the disaster? I mean, planning, clearly, yes. But just take me through the process.
Well, look, you have to understand the end game of it. If it's succession for growth, the end game is effectively constantly making yourself redundant to the performance of the business. It means you're constantly making space for you as the leader in the business to look at next level opportunities, next level growth. You need to get out of the kitchen in the day-to-day aspects of the business. If the end game is going to be a sale because you are in the services industry, you professional engineers or you architects, if that's the case, then you have to recognize the end game is all about handing over, valuing the business, getting paid, and getting paid over a period. Because if you're handing over and selling the business in effect to your leadership team, it's unlikely they will be able to pay you up front for that business. And that's why I always said the planning works on a 3x3 period. It takes 3 years to get that handover done properly in a structured way. And then it takes 3 years after that for you to get paid out in a structured way.
And the point is, if you make a duff decision, you don't ever get paid out. I mean, you talk to us enough about business failures, and you know, you don't set yourself up for succession success. You're setting yourself for succession failure, which is the same as shutting the doors the day you leave. It's just, you know, that would just be a lot less painful and a far quicker exit.
That's a far quicker exit. But, you know, the sad reality is that many people can't afford to. And they can't afford to for a couple of times. If you haven't gotten your head around the fact that of a day, if you haven't gotten your head around the fact that there is, there are not many absolute truths in the world, but absolute truths. But there is one absolute truth in business, and that is that every single business in the world, irrespective as to who you are, where you are, how you're thinking right now, only has one of two outcomes. It's either going to be a sale, an exit, or it's going to be a closure. And very often, especially when it comes to an exit through succession and people haven't thought it through, the terrifying aspects of handing over the responsibility of the business to the next generation of leaders in the business, Bruce, is you start to suddenly realize, if you're doing it well, that suddenly you're not the proximate cause of everything in the business. All those years of being needed and valued by your customers and your suppliers and your team, when you start to realize that when you're getting this right, that the business is continuing and you're not that vital in it, psychologically, it's a massive, massive leap that you have to get through.
I mean, it goes to the quality of your hiring process. If you are not hiring people who are capable of taking over from you, then you are a shocking manager of people, identifier of talent. I mean, if you, I talk, you know, some of the best business leaders I ever talked to is like this idea of making yourself obsolete, not too soon, but obsolete at a time of your choosing is probably the greatest. It's the greatest managerial skill, certainly in the corporate world. But that is the one skill that has to translate into the private sector too.
Completely. And, you know, I think often part of the reason why we get succession wrong so frequently or it's done so poorly is because there's a reliance purely on who the successor is. You know, you sit there, you look at your team, you might look at one or two leaders in your team or up-and-coming employees in your team, and say, right, I'm going to succeed my business to them. Why do you say that? Because maybe they perform well, but can they perform well without being led? So understanding what leadership is pretty vital in this instance. I think that a better approach to it is to build a business that can be succeeded. And building a business that can be succeeded really relies on how you design the entire business. A business doesn't just happen. It doesn't just emerge and appear. If a business is well built and it's got the Lego pieces properly put in place, you can, in effect, hand over responsibility Lego piece by Lego piece by Lego piece. The benefit of it is that that handover process is complete for each Lego piece before you move on to the next one. So the transfer needs to work in a very organized way. If at the same time you're collecting data around it and you're using information to manage how you identify the next area of handover and how handover takes place on a measured basis, it immediately puts you into a position with your successors that when you eventually exit the business, because you're going to be paid out over 3 years, the habits of how you plan each year, how you grow each year, and how you report on the performance of each year is already in place. And that gives you a whole breakfast of comfort around the fact that whilst you're not involved in the day-to-day, you can look at the data, make sure your business is being managed until you're fully paid out.
Pavlo Petidis at Auric Business Accelerator.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, collaborating with our clients in the pursuit of excellence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal Finance with Warren Ingram.
Personal Finance, Warren Ingram, Director at Galileo Capital and Executive Director there. He is a financial advisor in his own right. Does it always make sense to phase in your money into the stock market? Why don't you just keep the money in cash and then markets stabilize and then somebody rings a bell and then you buy shares and you get rich and life is good and easy? This thing of phasing money into stock markets, and I've confessed this before, Warren, that last year, because I'm smarter than everyone else in the world, I looked at my retirement annuity money and I went, you know what? Markets invariably end up going up in March, April and May. That's what usually happens. I'm not going to waste time phasing my pitiful little contributions to my retirement annuity into the market. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to pop it all in at once. What happened a month later? But the stock market fell on its face. And had I phased my money in, I would have bought a whole bunch of shares for less and be better off today. So what did I do this year? But I phased in my money. And so... what happened to stock markets from the 1st to the 31st of March? They went up. What did they do from the 31st of March to the 30th of April? They went up. What did they do from the 30th of April to the end of May? They went up. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't is my point.
I'm not sure that you are. I mean, I think you're talking about the first, let's say, 10 meters of a 10,000 meter run, and last year you started by running backwards, so you were running away from your goal, and this year you've started running towards your goal, and maybe you haven't started at flat out pace, but you've certainly started in the right direction. And you've got some energy banked, and you've got that. You can deploy that energy over time, and as things go, you'll get closer and closer to your goal. So I think your strategy this year was good. And I think the difficulty with phasing in always is it's so obvious in hindsight. And I think that's what we're talking about now is we're looking at the markets having risen, and risen very strongly, and then saying, well, that was silly. We should have just invested our money as lump sums and ridden out the losses. The problem is that falling markets aren't as kind to us when we get the decision wrong the other way. In other words, my favorite example of all time will be, investing your money on the 1st of January in the year 2000. And, the world is going incredibly well. Technology's changing the way everything's going to work. Everything, the economies are booming, everything is just going fantastically. And all of a sudden, the technology bubble bursts in America, especially actually in those days, it was really the internet bubble, not so much a broader technology bubble. And the stock market did absolutely nothing for people over a 10-year period. And that was only for people investing a lump sum at once. Anybody else who'd been phasing in for a few months before and a few months thereafter, or had started phasing in the middle of all of that noise and the disaster that was going on, they made money over that last decade. So I think understanding phasing in is to say that you're not going to aim for the very best returns you can possibly get. What you're trying to do is follow rule one from Mr. Warren Buffett, which is don't lose money. And that's really the starting point of any sensible investment strategy is if you can make sure that you can sort of say, I've got the 10,000 meter goal, and what I need to do today is make sure I start running in the right direction and keep going, and at some point I'll achieve my goal. Then you're doing the right thing. But to start off by running in the wrong direction is really that's the most destructive thing you can do.
I think
in an environment. Please go ahead.
No. You finish your point and then I'll make my better point.
So in an environment that we're in now, where the world is so volatile and there is so much news going on everywhere, I'm not even talking about, just in South Africa. You know, we look at, the deep fear that a lot of people have got about, the Chinese government, the Chinese regulators and the way they're, perceived to be attacking big companies and especially technology businesses in China. We look at the fears of inflation in America and, what's the Federal Reserve going to do there? And around the world, COVID's coming back and now there are discussions of fourth waves and fifth waves, et cetera. And the world's in a really kind of uncertain place. And so investors who are, wondering now if they should just wait, sit on the sidelines, wait for things to get better. I think they're the ones that are really doing themselves a disservice because the world can be incredibly uncertain for many years. That doesn't mean stock markets don't carry on rising. And that's always my great fear in a time like this is that people just, they allow, I'm agreeing it's logical that, that we should be concerned. It's a rational concern now. But they allow that concern to overwhelm the other part of the logic, which is markets tend to be volatile and that's the time they give you great opportunities to buy investments. And if you're sitting on the sidelines, you're missing out on all of those opportunities. And if you wait for things to get better, you're only buying investments when they're expensive already. And so you're absolutely hammering your ability to get any kind of return over time.
This is the point that Julia makes, either direct or indirectly, over her 14 years of experience that she shared with us for the last 10. And the fact is that she has added regularly, up until about 4 or 5 years ago, two investments each and every single month, contributing over a period of time about a third of her salary over a 10-year period. And where the markets were going up or markets were going down, Julia learned that you simply put your allocation into your investment portfolio. Some days you pay a bit too much for your assets and other days you pay far too little for your assets. But over time, you build an investment portfolio by leaving money in a bank account, in a current account, and waiting for opportunity means that you're always second guessing yourself. You never, ever are going to get it right, even half the time. And so slow and steady wins the race. It's classic rabbit and hare, sort of a tortoise and the hare, I beg your pardon, sort of tale.
Absolutely. And to your point around that, sitting with the money in cash and then looking at markets, my favorite kind of country for doing proper research is the Americans. And they look at this and they say, well, over the last 100 years, in every market scenario you can think of over that 100-year period, what happens to investors who've put their money, phased their money into the stock market compared to those that have had the money in cash? And it could be in the middle of a crash, it could be the end of a crash, anything, any scenario. In all instances, if you say out of every 100 scenarios there are where you could invest, in only 2 out of 100 is it better for investors to have been in cash and sat on the sidelines compared to those who just put their money in a phasing in strategy and looking at what happens over the subsequent decade. So over 100 years of market history, you take every single day out of that 100-year history, and those are the thousands and thousands and thousands of scenarios that they're working on. And really, 2 out of 100 times, you're better off in cash, which tells me those are awful odds. To kind of say half the time, half the time would be a reasonable set of odds, but 2 out of 100, it just tells me that phasing in is almost always a better strategy than sitting in purely in cash. There are people who would argue, the mathematicians would argue that actually what you should do is always just invest your lump sums in one shot, and don't worry about the market volatility. Unfortunately, there are many more times where that strategy could actually hurt you and cause a permanent loss of capital. And so to me, I want the best of all worlds, which is, listen to Mr. Buffett and don't lose money. And in other words, phase in. And if you miss out on some extra growth, that's okay. But losing money on a permanent basis to me is never okay. And so I'm happy to kind of be the tortoise in this. I'll gladly wear that as a crown, in fact, and be proud about it. I'm going to be the tortoise, but I am going to get to my 10,000 meter goal. And I'm not in a race with anybody else except myself.
Warren Ingram is a financial advisor. He is a director at Galileo Capital, talking tortoise and hare strategies this evening. And good, valuable, and not that common sense, frankly, because there's nothing common about common sense, but some good advice from Warren this evening. Then we got an email, Warren, from Libby Richardson, who is a third-year civil engineering student at Stellenbosch University. And Libby has a growing interest in investments. Now, Libby has a great question for us. She wants to invest in a company, just one, with a very strong focus on sustainability or renewable energy. And she's wondering if you've got any advice, because pinpointing such a company on the JSE list of companies doesn't seem like a productive way of going about it. So I'm going to make that your problem, answering Libby Richardson's question, third-year civil engineering student from Stellenbosch University. We'll get to that question with Warren Ingram in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, collaborating with our clients in the pursuit of excellence. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
So, I suppose it's logical to suggest that any company that doesn't focus on being sustainable is therefore unsustainable, therefore you shouldn't invest in it, Warren. I mean, is that too simple an argument to make in this very big and complicated and quite messy debate around what is and is not sustainable?
Yeah, it is a very nuanced issue, because for example, let's just talk about a massive oil company that makes most of its money from drilling fossil fuels. If a company like that, at the moment will be one of the biggest polluters and one of the biggest sort of destructors of the environment, if they decide to turn their attention to becoming an energy company as opposed to a pure fossil fuel company, and then, more importantly, say we're going to, on a scale, on a real big scale, start providing renewable energy to our customers. They've got the history of being able to move energy from deep underground, into your car or into your house or whatever the deal is. They understand big business in a big way. And if a company like that decides to move, 30% of its energy to renewable energies, and over time, goes to 50, 60, 70, then to me, that they have a very good argument for attracting sustainable investment money, because the reality is that they can really move the needle. They can really change change the world. Whereas if it was you and me, Bruce, in our garage, and we decide we're going to start a renewable energy company on no scale and just see what we can do, we might be pure and completely clean from day one, but we might not have any impact on anybody outside of our own houses, and potentially upsetting our wives because we've messed up the garage. And so the reality is, I think that we can't be too purist in a world like this. We've got to say, are there companies making meaningful impact on reducing, whether it's the environmental issues, whether it's the inequality, whether it's racial inequality, governance issues, all of those. There are so many big issues around sustainable investing that I think it is a massively complex field.
I think your main point is there is no perfection. There is no pure play of a company that takes oxygen and hydrogen and turns it into the purest, cleanest water in the world, or an oxygen purification company, or a company that just plants by hand, reseeds the Amazon rainforest. Those sorts of investment opportunities I don't think exist.
And if they do, they're probably very small businesses that are starting out, and then we've got to change hats and say, if your job as an investor is to grow your money as well, then you don't have to do it to the distraction of the world. I mean, I think that's a terrible way to do things, but at the same time, you need to focus on creating sustainable financial positions as well, and that's where the world unfortunately is murky. And so I think that an element of pragmatism in this is critical, but that doesn't mean that we allow greenwashing, for example, as well, or you know, where companies just you know tick some boxes on a spreadsheet to say no, we you know we comply, because that you know that's also wrong. And I think unfortunately that's what happened here. You know, many years ago there were sort of these you know green ETFs and green investments, and they were awful. So to give Libby a kind of a clear point, I think there you know there are some big index providers now you know that have built a proper the phrase Libby is ESG, environmental, social, and governance investments, and you can buy an exchange traded fund in South Africa. You know, if you just look for ESG exchange traded funds, you'll find you know a choice now, and you know the work that's being done by these index providers is good. It's not perfect, as we said. But certainly you can start to allocate your money to these exchange traded funds with a fairly good clear conscience that you are helping, you know, and at the same time, I think the next decade, two or three, you'll actually see that, you know, these will outperform the more traditional indices and the more old world companies that don't adapt to how the world is and needs to move. So I think ESG is a great theme. I think it's a great investment theme just as a standalone thing. But actually, more importantly, you know, it is the way we need to allocate our money to force businesses to change and move in the right direction.
Fabulous. Thank you, Warren. And then we need a phrase of the week. And this phrase, I'm not too sure whether it is on the top of my list or second on my list. I'm still getting over my hatred of the term innovation, because it just got so badly abused and misappropriated and utilized in the wrong way. This phrase is fourth industrial revolution. It is a figment of the imagination of the World Economic Forum. It's a wonderful way of describing a future, perhaps that is going to be, you know, artificial intelligence driven and the way in which it's going to work. But my goodness me, it's been horribly abused.
It has been, and of course, you know, financial services companies are never slow to sell you a fashion, you know, and I think that's what we've seen here. You know, there are companies that are selling fourth industrial revolution funds as if, you know, they're going to be the answer to all investment problems as well. And so just briefly, you know, the term fourth industrial revolution, it's basically where technology in its broadest sense, whether it's medical technology, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, all forms of technology intersect with you know, the kind of the physical human world. And, you know, the most basic example I can think of is, you know, none of us, you know, kind of carry map books anymore. You know, we carry, you know, maps on our phones and we tell the phone where we want to go and we listen to it, you know, faithfully in my case, until it takes us to where we need to be. And you know that's a form of where technology and my human requirements intersect. So it can be a big you know game changer. But again, from an investment point of view, you know to be early on a theme like that is not necessarily the way to make money. You know, I'm happy to be a fast follower when I look at these trends. And you know I think we've got a real example with these vaccines. You know, the biotechnology involved in creating the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccines are real examples of how this is changing our lives already in a very rapid and very real way. But be careful that you know that you think that all of these are just going to be great investments. Unfortunately, sometimes you know there are only one or two of these that actually come out of this as high quality investment opportunities for individuals as well.
Warren Ingram, Galileo Capital. Thank you, Warren. He is our regular commentator on everything to do with personal finance. Libby, I hope you're not too disappointed with the response, but that's the reality of the world in which we're living at the moment. Thank you, Warren.